Well, Santayana was no doubt thinking of people when he said, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." Could not Santayana have said the same thing about plants? This thought leads us to ask, what will happen to people if plants forget their past?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. Michael Olson. This is the Food Chain Radio program, and you are tuned into the Food Chain. Michael Olson, today we're going to have a fun conversation about the seeds in my office. Folks, there is a long strip of seeds hanging in the office. I got them from a little Indian gal on the road to Machu Picchu, pretty close to Cusco. We pulled over, and there next to the road is a beautiful overlook of the Urubamba Valley, and there's a Indian gal there with selling seeds, long strips of seeds to tourists. And I thought, this is the most wonderful tourist trinket I've ever seen in my life. Because the seeds, there were 17 varieties of corn in this packet of seeds. And so by golly, I thought, this is extraordinary. And so I brought them home and hung them in my office. And when visitors come to my office and look at these seeds, they go, wow, look at all the colors. Now, you and I, when we think of seeds, you know, we think of the little yellow seed kernels, and that's that. But these seeds are all kinds of different colors and shapes and sizes. So when people ask about them, I explain that seeds earn their intelligence. Plants earn their intelligence through experience. For an example, when an environment heats up, plants that can tolerate the heat survive and pass that ability on to the next generation via the seeds. People not so smart, right? Seems like each one of us has to burn our fingers before we can fix what is too hot in our mind. But the intelligence of plants is fine-tuned by environment. Thus, corn that grows and develops in the Urubamba River Valley of Peru is different than corn that grows and develops in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. The intelligence to grow and develop in response to a specific environment is the plant's genetic heritage, and thus we often call these plants heritage plants. So when people ask about the different colors, shapes, and sizes of corn that they find hanging in my office, I say they are heritage seeds from the Urubamba River Valley in Peru. When we all lived on the land, heritage plants were very important because they had the intelligence to grow where we lived. But we have all since moved into town and now rely on the foods of industry to survive. The plants of industry have a different kind of intelligence. Corn, for example, may now contain the intelligence to kill insect pests and to withstand chemical herbicides that kill all the other plants around it. This intelligence makes it very easy for one farmer to grow a lot of corn, and thus the industrial corn we see is rapidly supplanting all the heritage varieties we once valued so highly. This loss of genetic diversity leads us to ask, kind of look back over our shoulders, you know, as we motor on down the road of progress, we kind of look back and want to ask, in all seriousness, what will happen to us, to we the people, if plants forget their past? Well, here to help us out today, to play with this question, we have David Buchanan, who's the author of Taste Memory, Forgotten Foods, Lost Flavors, and Why They Matter. David, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi, Michael. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Well, very good to have you aboard. You're up there in the northeast of the country. You've got hurricanes. You've got blizzards. How's it going up there these days?
I actually wish the snow would stick around a little bit longer because I'm a fanatical Nordic skier, and even a week after our record-setting blizzard, it's melting away.
Oh, I'll give you the best place in the world to do Nordic skiing is in the Lamar Valley of Yellowstone Park. Ever get a chance, try that one out. Oh, my goodness.
Headed out to Washington State next week to the Metow Valley, which is also a wonderful place to go skiing.
Well, good for you. So you wrote a book about essentially heritage foods. So were you kind of like trucking along one day and you tasted something and said, wow, this is really extraordinary. What is it?
It was something like that. I think I was as captivated by the idea as I was by any particular food. Back in the 80s, I started reading about heritage foods through the Seed Savers Exchange in Iowa and Gary Nabhan's writings and Native Seed Search. And I got really excited because, to me, these foods are an integral part of human history and culture. And I'd never come across the idea before. And so it was something eye-opening to me.
Well, David, you know, some say we city people have a pretty good deal when it gets right down to it. We get to hang around the office for a few hours every day and answer some telephone calls and shoot off some emails and then head home for a cold beer and some cheap food. And they think, you know, that's a pretty good life. You know, why mess with it? And why go against that whole thing and look at heritage foods? Because, you know, that's work you're talking about, isn't it?
I ask myself that some days, but I think I have a pretty nice balance. I actually live in downtown Portland, Maine, and lease land outside of the city, although we have recently purchased a small farm about 20 minutes north of town that we're turning into a kind of conservation center. But I do believe that's a really valid question. The work that goes into small-scale agriculture is something that is a society we don't value as much as we could, and it's a tough way for many farmers to make a living. I personally can't really bear to sit at a desk all day. I've got too much energy and love to be outdoors, and so this is the perfect life for me.
Yeah, and who says it's fun to sit at a desk all day and talk on the phone and send emails anyway, right? You know, I got to thinking about our subject today, you know, heritage crops and thinking back, and I got to wondering, you know, as we motor down the road of progress and go farther and farther into this city living that we're headed into, how on earth do we know what we're missing if we've never tasted it before?
Well, I think increasingly food access is something on everyone's mind, and even in most urban areas, there are farmers markets sprouting up. Urban gardening is a very worthy and active movement. And there are a lot of ways to get your hands in the dirt even when you live in a highly urban place. I helped to build a community garden a few years ago in Lawrence, Massachusetts, in an alley in a highly urban setting. And it was an immigrant community, and the people there were hungry to get out and do something physical to grow some vegetables. So I think it's possible to reconnect with the land and with food almost regardless of where you live these days.
Well, you know, I get to thinking, you know, I sometimes think what they want us to eat is some kind of perfectly safe food manufactured from, you know, genetically engineered soybeans that have been ground up into a meal and flavored with this and that, and it come in a brightly colored package. And so we eat it, and there we're happy and easily controlled. But will we know that we're missing something when that happens? Will we have this, you and I have this sense that, gosh, we're really missing something real?
Well, I come at this from two places. I come at it, I suppose, from an environmental perspective. I love the New England landscape and love to see a working landscape and believe that there's value in continuing to work these fields despite a lot of the challenges. And I also come at it from a place of pleasure and taste. I've been very involved with the slow food movement over the years, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with, and helped start and then ran a chapter in Portland several years ago. And the slow food philosophy is maybe very Italian, this idea, and radical, the idea that we can transform the world through pleasure and that we can know what's good for the planet, what's good for ourselves through the pleasures of the table and through taste. And So maybe that processed GMO soybean isn't going to cut it when we get right down to what we want to see on our plates.
Well, in that regards, then we're kind of being counter-revolutionary, are we not? You know, the revolution being, my goodness, we're able now to re-engineer seeds. And what we're talking about is saying, well, wait a minute, maybe we're missing something. By turning our backs on all that has come before, maybe we're going to miss something very important. Well, I guess that's the subject of the show today. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with David Buchanan, author of Taste Memory. And I bet you have a lot of memories of taste that have come and gone. I certainly do myself. Thinking back to my grandfather's apple orchard, for one. And then tasting those red delicious apples that taste like mush. For another. This is the Food Chain. Join us if you wish. 831-479-1080. Right back with David Buchanan and you.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, I think it was Santayana who said, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. You know, so we do remember our past, but so do plants. And we got to thinking about this whole issue of plants and their genetic heritage, and we got to wondering, what will happen to people if plants forget their past? This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with David Buchanan. Today, a quick shout out and welcome to our new friends who are tuned in Missouri, Iowa, and Illinois on WGEM, the River City there, right on the Miss Mark Twain country. Thanks for joining us on the Food Chain. So happy to have you aboard WGEM. Folks, we're talking with David Buchanan about a heritage of plants with respect to where they grew up and whatnot. David, you know, we now have the opportunity to walk into a supermarket just about any time of year and grab a red delicious and take a big chunk, big bite out of it. But that's not really what we're talking about, is it?
No, though I'd like to point out the Red Delicious does have its place.
It
actually makes a fairly aromatic cider. It's a low acid, so it's not so good for the hard ciders that I'm making on one level. But many of these fruits have their place, and part of the trouble is just that we've forgotten about the breadth and the richness that's available and focused only on a handful.
Well, why is it that we got so focused on Red Delicious? What happened there?
That's a good question. I have a hard time answering that when it comes to a few varieties like that I can't really stomach myself. I'm not even much of a fan of Macintosh, although there are some strains of Mac that are tastier than others. I actually had a pretty good Mac yesterday. I think the answer has to do with some combination of shipping and storage and consumer preference, and we've lost a lot of the older varieties simply because you can only sell so much in the supermarket. You can only have so much complexity before the consumer throws up their hands and doesn't know what to select.
Well, and that's certainly true with me because I don't know what to select. So when I go to the farmer's market, there's the family there that grows their all kinds of apples, and I don't know what to. I taste a bunch of them, and they all taste so wonderfully delicious and different. So I always end up, what should I eat now? And they tell me, try this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I buy them, take them home, and we go through the apples, and it's a wonderful experience, but they're all different. Now, the thing about Red Delicious, I guess, is that they're beautiful.
I think that's the main selling point, yeah. And from the grower's perspective, I picked some at Red Delicious, and they seem to be fairly disease resistant and resistant and prolific. So they're unlike Mac, which is a difficult apple to grow. That might be one reason that they're in the market. From the grower's perspective, if you're trying to sell 50 different kinds of fruit, you've got to get your timing just right, because the apples are ripening at different times. Not only do you have to get that message across to the consumer that you might really like this apple, but yeah, you wanted to buy it this week, but not next week. Next week you have to buy this other apple, and it becomes very complex.
Well, especially if you're selling through a mass market. Now, is the supermarket what's really changing our the way we eat?
I think inevitably, as we moved around away from hands-on involvement in the land, here in Maine, it's estimated that backyard farmers, gardeners grew at least 400 different varieties of apples alone.
400?
Well, 400 to 600, as well as all kinds of other fruits and all kinds of other vegetables. And so inevitably, as we moved away from that, there was sometimes an unconscious, sometimes conscious decision to winnow out the underperformers and to focus on the star attractions.
Mm-hmm. So inevitably, it's going to happen one way or another, right? Whether you're in a supermarket or whether you're in a great, big, huge, giant farmer's market, you're still going to you're not going to have 600 apple trees in your backyard. So you're going to have to make some decisions
the
here.
Supermarket. And so it goes back to the commercialization of fruit production in the 19th century. Even back then, this process was underway.
Mm-hmm. So then, are we not kind of talking about horse and buggy agriculture then in looking back to heirloom varieties of crops?
I hope not. Although I'm writing about heritage foods, I'm very much a proponent of ongoing plant breeding and animal breeding as long as it's in the best interest of the farmer and the consumer. So I almost feel like I need a new way to talk about this, because it's not simply looking back and thinking nostalgically about these foods and trying to preserve them as they are. Because after all, this is all living material, and whether we consciously select or whether we consciously breed or try to maintain the lines, they're going to evolve over time. And so to me, it's not about nostalgia. It's about making these foods current and maintaining diversity and adaptation to place and focusing on taste and good horticultural practices and something that works for the farmer and the eater.
Mm-hmm. But why bother? And this is a question that I'm sure, you know, some people are out there thinking, why bother messing around with all of that really hands-on, you know, tough-to-do kinds of things when we can just re-engineer what plants do by re-engineering their genetics? Now, you know, with respect to corn, for example, we now have corn, patented varieties of corn that have been re-engineered so that they can, those corn plants can actually kill the bugs that try to eat it and can withstand the herbicide that farmers apply to kill all the other plants. And boy, this makes it really easy to grow corn. I mean, one farmer can grow like 1,000 acres of corn.
Mm-hmm.
So why mess around with something that's old and unable to do that? They can't do those kinds of tricks.
Well, there are a lot of different approaches to breeding, and I'm not a scientist, so I can't address the possibilities of technology to replace everything that we have in our hands today. But I would say that most breeders would probably agree that you need to maintain these old lines so that you keep genetic traits that could be introduced into plants in the future. You don't know what exists. And this is why we have gene banks, why every country in the world is maintaining its diversity on some level. We have an extensive network of gene banks in this country. This is why we maintain those plants. It's partly for the cultural history, but it's also because we don't know when we might need that that corn gene that provides resistance to drought, as in a year like this, where because all of the plants were in so many regions were genetically uniform, they were all setting pollen at the same time and all susceptible to the same heat waves striking across the Midwest. So these are traits that may be valuable in the future.
And there is, of course, in history, examples of what happens when we lose the genetic diversity. I'm thinking, of course, of the Irish potato famine, right?
Yes, the lumper potato, which was the culprit in the potato famine, was a high-yielding potato that the Irish peasants gradually used to replace many of their other varieties because of its yield, but it was extremely susceptible to late blight, and we know the result, tragic.
But it was the best that they had at the time, so everybody bought into it, and that was the case then. So, you know, we're talking about preserving these genetics, and that we do have seed banks. But who's responsible for preserving genetics?
Well, that's a difficult question. It takes a lot of resources to maintain a gene bank, and there are different approaches to ease some of the labor and to put some of the genetics into longer-term storage. I believe on some level that it's up to gardeners to carry the torch as well. I believe that if we don't keep this material in circulation, make it current, put it into our farms and our gardens, that it might as well disappear. That it's important from a cultural standpoint as well as an ecological and agricultural perspective to keep these foods in circulation and continue to evolve with them.
Okay, we're going to go to the phones when we get back. Folks, you can join us if you wish. 831-479-1080. Right back with David Buchanan and you, Heritage Foods. Hey, welcome back. Food Chain Radio Program. What about those apples in your refrigerator? Do you have something that's really unique and full of flavor? Or are you eating those mushy, red, delicious apples that look so beautiful but have absolutely no character? Well, that's kind of the subject today we're picking up. Heritage foods. Those foods that have been bred and grew up in for specific purposes in specific locations, and so have developed the intelligence to respond to that environment and to provide us with those kinds of qualities. Or are we living now on purely industrial foods? And that's kind of the question of the day. What happens if we lose all of those heritage seeds and become totally dependent on those industrial foods? That's the question we're picking up with David Buchanan, author of Taste, Memory, and You. Right now we're going to go to the phones, 831-479-1080, and we're going to pick up Wendy. Wendy, welcome to the Food Chain Radio Program.
Oh, thank you, Michael, and thank you, David, for all your good work.
Thanks,
I like
Wendy.
To think we're over the peak of the diversity loss. You see so much more coming into stores than you did when I was younger.
Which is a total pain in the butt for storekeepers, right?
I think that so much has happened as far as being able to find information online easier when something they don't understand comes in, for the marketers as well as the consumers. And I see that the connection between online people and, you know, in California we have much more industrial agriculture than, you know, back east in New England or in some of your new areas in the middle of the country where you get rain in the summer. Here we can control the harvest. We just don't make it wet, and you can use these huge machines. Whereas I, back in near Syracuse, New York, all these wonderful tiny little farms that just you just didn't see in the West.
And those look like large farms to me out in Syracuse. From Maine.
Out here, they're.
But wait a minute. Why is it that we do not have them here, Wendy, in California?
You can turn the water off, and you can send in your huge combines. You can send in huge groups that go from one farm to another, mechanized, We know when we're harvesting, there's not going to be any rain, there's not going to be water, it's not going to mildew on us. Whereas if you don't know when it's going to rain, you want, you know, a small package of people going out to the, you know, farmer or individual farmers.
Mm-hmm.
Out here, though, we have a huge amount of backyards. And, you know, they want something. And to use, you know, networking online to get, you know, the regional expert, you know, this guy in his backyard is the expert on this kind of apple or on this, you know, kind of tomato. Heritage Tomatoes are doing wonderful. We had, I was around the corner from Love Apple Farms when they started.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of tomatoes that they have brought into this region is just amazing.
Let me ask you a quick question, Wendy. What part should consumers play in the preservation of heritage foods?
I think interest. Interest, and there's a lot of laws that make it so corporations don't want to go into anything more diverse. If it's, you can patent all kinds of medicines, but the different carbohydrates, the different nuances of different foods, you can't patent. It's just food. So corporations don't think they can make more money by bringing these things out. And you can cure a lot of diseases by different carbohydrate antigens, which is what these heritage foods give us a variety of.
Uh-huh. So we
look into politics too.
Yeah, but do you think consumers have a responsibility for demanding different, something other than Red Delicious apples? Or
I don't know if it's. I am almost thinking of it more as a hobby level at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to want to do it. You know, and also for your health. I think that's a big thing, that if you're getting different nutrients from, you know, you have different plant taking different things from the soil, you bring in a lot of nuances that take care of different parts of your body. And I hope that we can encourage people to demand.
If I could say one thing to your comments, I love the way you started off by saying, imagining that maybe we have turned the tide, that the loss of genetic diversity has slowed. And I think it's valuable to remember that in this country, although the major thrust of agriculture and the seed industry may be moving in a different direction, that we are very lucky to have a thriving seed industry, small seed industry, that focuses on diversity. We have some wonderful companies here in Maine and around the country that are working to bring these older foods back, to breed regionally, work with farmers and in participatory projects to create new regionally adapted foods and to rescue the old. And then we have the thriving farmers market movement and small market garden movement that is really embracing many of these foods. And that's in a lot of ways unique to the United States. I've been to other parts of the world that actually look to California and to the states as inspiration because we are doing a lot to protect our diversity.
I think you get to a level of affluence where you want more.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
Like I've written down your Seed Saver Exchange here, and out here, Seeds of Change is another one that you
mm-hmm.
see more garden
yeah.
centers and. You know, it's a new demand. It's the next part of the wheel. We've hopefully gone over, you know, that the ability to think that it was okay to just have Red Delicious apples. But thank you so much for your good work.
Well, hey, Wendy, can I ask you a quick question before you run off?
Mm-hmm.
So, what will happen to people if plants forget their past? If we just end up with Red Delicious apples?
I think we'll be very boring.
Good point. Thank you very much, Wendy. Appreciate
yes,
it.
I agree.
We become boring. You know, part of the title of your book is taste. What role does taste play in all of this?
Well, boredom is a factor. I think mm-hmm. that there is a level of creativity and interest and the flavor keeps it all so lively and interesting. And I think a lot about I live in a food town. Portland, Maine is a wonderful place to eat.
I'm gonna have to visit that place.
Definitely the confluence of small growers and creative chefs has made it a wonderful food destination, and taste is a driving force, and it's not something to be taken lightly. It's not, let's not be too righteous about it. There's a lot of pleasure to be gained in this movement, and there's value in that. There's nothing wrong with appreciating the flavors and the richness of it, because this is an important legacy, and it's so much of human history and culture is bound up in the development of these wonderful foods, and let's appreciate them. Let's value them.
Well, that kind of takes me back to a question that I raised earlier. What happens if we don't know what things taste like anymore? What happens if we think all apples taste like those mushy, red, delicious apples that have no taste or no character? What happens when we lose the memory of taste?
We already have lost the memory, and how wonderful to think of the opportunity to regain it. I'm myself collecting all kinds of fruits, and I have about 160 varieties of apples now, and I've only about a third of those have started to bear. So in the next few years, I've got a real adventure ahead of me in tasting and blending ciders and all kinds of fun. So I think that you can look at this as an opportunity.
And we'll be right back with more opportunity on the food chain. David Buchanan, 831-479-1080. Well, folks, they say we are what we eat. If such is the case, then what will we become if we lose our heritage foods and just must live within the foods of industry, those genetically foods manufactured from genetically engineered corn and genetically engineered soybeans and ground up into meal and flavored with nanoparticles or whatever and put into brightly packaged things that sit on the supermarket shelves for like Hostess Twinkies or something. What will we become if that's what we eat? And I guess you're out to make certain that won't happen with 137 varieties of apples. Right, David Buchanan?
Well, I'm part of a movement, I hope.
Well, and that's part of what we want to talk about. We want to talk about how we can get this movement going. Right now, we're going to go quickly to the phone and talk with Joe. Joe, welcome to the food chain. What do you think about this notion of diversity in our foods?
Well, I'm for more diversity, complete diversity. And that's why genetically modified foods are a part of that food diversity.
Fair enough.
It helps to give us the full spectrum. It's sorely needed, not only to feed a hungry world, but also to provide all those nuances of tastes and textures that our palates just go bonkers over.
I agree, and that's one of the things about that. That's one of my questions, is why actually try to preserve heritage foods when we can just and re-engineer all of those tastes and things ourselves? What do you think?
I feel that the important question is the motivations of the breeder. Whose interests lie behind the breeding project? Is it the consumer and the farmer, or is it simply a product that touches the bottom line? So to me, the breeding approach, as I said earlier, I'm not a scientist, so I don't want to speak to any one breeding approach, is almost secondary to the intent, the politics and the economics behind it. And if the intent is to breed a single seed that'll be grown across vast swaths of land and to displace greater diversity, then that obviously raises red flags for me. But then anytime you breed anything, an animal or a plant, you're balancing one concern against another. You might be balancing trying to decide how much to weight taste versus yield versus drought tolerance versus pest tolerance, and all of these things go into the mix and have to be judged. So I feel like in any discussion like this, the devil is in the details. What are the intentions of the company that's breeding this plant?
One last thing I want to point out. Without prosperity, they won't be able to maintain this diversity. There has to be a profit motive, and that's as old as time itself.
Good question. Joe, let me ask Joe to respond to David's notion of intent.
Intent?
Yes. What do you think about the importance of why?
It's important. That is part of a moral society, an ethical society. part of that is a reasonable, realistic, and natural intent to survive the species and ourselves individually.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is, it is morally, it's a high moral value to provide as much tasty, healthy food as possible to as many of our fellow human beings and our animals that we raise as possible.
Do you think that diversity should be part of that equation?
It is imperative. And again, genetically modified is a vital, integral, and necessary part of all that diversity.
Thank you very much for that comment, Joe.
I could say one more thing.
Go right ahead.
Right at the outset of my book, I say that I'm not an advocate for any one way of producing food, that I'm really exploring questions of this biodiversity and richness. And so I am not a proponent for any one way of growing. I am certified organic, but I believe that everyone can make their own decisions about these issues. And the bottom line, of course, is that we do need to produce as much food as we can, and we need to adapt and think about a lot of these issues. But it's complex, and so sometimes I think this debate gets mired in buzzwords, and it's, as I said earlier, the devil's in the details.
Okay, great. Jack, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that that human beings are kind of at a precipice right now where they have a good deal of knowledge, but the amount of knowledge that they have is not really, they think they know it all, but they really don't know that much. And I think that the real reason behind the need for genetic diversity is that we don't know what's out there, and we don't know what can happen because of what we're doing with genetic engineering, and it's necessary that that we have the full range of everything that has been developed over the millions of years of life on this planet. And not just a single idea that somebody in a laboratory has brewed up because they think they know what is necessary in all situations.
Well, the Irish knew all about potatoes.
Well, you know, and they did good, fine, but they didn't know about growing potatoes in you know, different various regions. And as far as the nutritional quality of the potatoes that they're growing, maybe there's something. You know, maybe there's better potatoes somewhere else. You know.
Well, and the point was they knew all about growing potatoes and grew the best potato, until that potato collapsed and then they starved.
And again, I think it's important to look at the politics and the economics around the potato famine, because it wasn't just about the agronomy. The Irish were growing a wealth of different kinds of potatoes, but there were a lot of other pressures that were brought to bear on it.
Hey, we're gonna have to take a quick break. Right back. Do stay tuned. So much to talk about, so little time. Well, folks, should we preserve the heritage of plants? Why bother when it's so easy just to re-engineer them? And that's the question we have on the table today with David Buchanan, author of Taste Memory. David is taking upon himself to save as many things as he can. What can we do as consumers to help out, to help save things that should be saved, David? First of all, how do we know what should be saved?
That's a difficult question, and I would say that one answer is to think of ourselves not only as consumers, but also as participants. Gardening is I believe still the foremost American hobby, and every gardener can have a real role to play in this. And so anybody who's willing to plant a few seeds of tomatoes or peppers outside their door can help to preserve those varieties. And really there's no substitute for that level of freshness and hands-on involvement. There's nothing like going out your door to pick a vine-ripened tomato. And a lot of the best of these foods really don't adapt to the market. Maybe they don't ship, they don't keep, they can't be grown on a commercial scale. But the only reason that they're not available is because we're not growing them any longer. And so I feel like it really is important that people participate. And then we also get away from these questions of elitism and cost, because suddenly it's really just about having that time and that willingness to grow a bit of your own food.
As gardeners, we can plant seeds. As consumers, absolutely, what can we do?
As consumers, we can support small-scale farmers who are working to protect regional varieties or trying to breed for local conditions. Here in Maine, we have very different growing conditions from Central California, and so we have different needs in our seeds and our plants. And
do you know, one of the most disappointing things in the world is to travel far and wide and always get stuck with the same foods.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, like, to me, going to San Antonio, Texas, for example, and expecting to get Southern cooking and ending up at a Hooters or something like that. It's like, what an insult to travel, to have everything turn into the same stuff to eat. So, David, let me ask you that question that kind of popped into my mind as I was considering this heritage business. What will happen to people if plants forget their past and become and lose that heritage?
Well, sure. I think part of what draws me to this is the cultural richness. To me, plant breeding, growing these foods is one of the oldest of human arts, and it's the heart of human culture. Agriculture, culture, closely tied ideas. And it is, I couldn't agree more that I am very disheartened to travel around the country or around the world and go into markets and find the same kinds of foods. And so to me, part of it is about richness and tradition and appreciating and valuing and celebrating the achievements of our forebears. And when we think of all of the creativity that's gone into the development of these foods, it just feels disrespectful to let them go.
And what happens to us if we lose it?
Well, I can't answer that, really. I think that...
You don't have to answer it. It's just a thought to let go with. Folks, this has been The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with David Buchanan, author of Memory Taste. Read it and eat it. Thank you, David.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure, Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.